Welcome to the NOLA Drink Show. Join us as we explore the world of drink, food, and culture in New Orleans and beyond. Here's your host, Brian Diaz.
All right, everybody, thanks for listening into the show this week, friends. I do appreciate it. As always, have a really good show coming up for you here today. One of the shows that we recorded at Tales of the Cocktail, which took place about 2 weeks ago, and also part of our sustainability series, which I'll get to in a second. And friends, if you listen to the show regularly or you're already familiar with Tales of the Cocktail, one of the great things about it is we get a wonderfully diverse set of extremely talented people who work in the hospitality, liquor, bartending world, and they all come here to New Orleans every July. It's the largest conference for bartenders in the spirits industry in the world, and here at the NOLA Drink Show, we are certain to take advantage of all of these terrific folks being in town and try and tab a few people to come on and chat with us here on the show. This year, we worked with our friends at Tales of the Cocktail directly to identify some show topics, largely based on seminars that they were offering to those in attendance, and that is one of the examples that we have here today, talking about sexual harassment, violence, and assault in the hospitality industry, something we've talked about on the show before. If you're a regular listener, you know that, but ways to address it, ways to mitigate it, ways to eliminate it. We come at it from the perspective of what people in the industry can do, and we talk a bit about the patron side as well, and a lot of the dynamics, I'll use that word, that can be in play when you're in a hospitality space, a bar where there's alcohol, other considerations of how sexual assault, violence, and harassment takes place. I don't think it's that much of a mystery to anyone out there. You're probably not surprised to hear that, but it's something that certainly needs to be addressed for the well-being of patrons and certainly the well-beings of our friends that work in the hospitality industry. This particular show, very pleased to have three great guests, Chantel Jardet, who is a certified counselor based in Philadelphia, who is also the panel moderator. The panel is called What's My Role? Responding to the Rising Need for Sexual Violence Prevention in Nightlife and Hospitality Spaces. In addition to Chantel, we also have Christina Vera, who comes from Toronto with a large resume of having worked in various aspects of the hospitality industry and working to address these issues there. And our friend Amy Noto, who is from New Orleans, worked in the hospitality industry for a long time and now works for the terrific organization, the Star Program, as a counselor, and she is their point person because of her experience largely in the hospitality industry and now moving into counseling for Star, and we talk about these issues. It's a great show, an important show, and an engaging show, and we hope you get something from it and also can really help to be someone who works to avert, mitigate, and eliminate sexual harassment, violence, and assault in the hospitality industry, whether you're a patron or whether you are in the industry. And friends, I mentioned our sustainability series. If you've been listening to the show, you know we've been doing various shows that connect to the broader idea of sustainability. We take a wide stance to what that means. Of course, it's always going to have a connection to drink and food and culture, as we do here on the NOLA Drink Show. It can be environmental stuff, right? Eliminating or reducing waste in bars, plastic straws, that sort of thing. Cultural sustainability, protecting those and the cultures and the ways of life of people who make things that we enjoy in the hospitality and liquor industry, like mezcal or pisco or something like that. And certainly, as this topic today relates to, the sustainability of our friends who work in the industry, work-life balance, physical and mental wellness, and then, of course, things like the prevalence of sexual assault that can take place in these spaces and in this industry to these people, or in situations where they are the frontline foot soldiers, if you will, facing it down every day or often frequently in the job when you're there at a restaurant or a bar. So that is a very broad stance, obviously, that we take on sustainability, but that's really what it is all about and something that you're going to see us continue to address here on the NOLA Drink Show as we move forward. So watch out for shows that connect to those topics, and we'll have more on our website coming very soon where those shows will be broken out for you to easily find if those are things that you're interested in. Want to give a special shout out to our good friends at Two Jags Restaurant, the second oldest restaurant in New Orleans, established in 1856. They allowed us to tape this show and another couple, that one you heard last week with Jeff Beachbum Berry and Dave Wondrich, and we'll have one more coming out in a week or two also that we tape there at Two Jags. So thanks to them, 800 block of Decatur Street. Go check them out. Great bar and great food. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the NOLA Drink Show. Then we are going to be back with our featured interview with Chantel, Christina, and Amy. Come on back. Thank you.
Dad's been shucking dozens since 42. Iron tub ice down full of Falstaff brew. Black head of son Bobby Charles.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the program. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Yeah, we're here in New Orleans, Tales of the Cocktail. That's already happened when you're hearing this, friends. But we're here at Two Jags Restaurant on Decatur, second oldest restaurant in New Orleans. Thanks to them for hosting us. And today, as part of our sustainability series, where we are talking about a very important issue in the hospitality, service, liquor industry, sexual assault, and sexual violence. And I have three fantastic guests to help me to teach me about this topic. Amy Noto, a good friend of mine here in town. Amy, how are you?
I'm doing good.
It's good to see you again.
Yeah, you too.
Yeah, I haven't seen you in a while. So
it's been a minute.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And Chantel Jardet, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much. And Christina Vera, how are you?
I'm great, thanks.
Hey, great. Thanks for making time. And you came all the way from Toronto. So
all the way from up north, yeah.
And Chantel, where are you from, actually?
I actually have spent, I just recently relocated to Philly from New York, where I was for the past 16 years. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Are you in New York? Originally,
or? I am not actually. My family's from New Orleans, but I was a military brat, so I grew up all over. Yeah, but
okay.
Made New York my home until now, just recently.
Gotcha, gotcha. And, yeah. And since I mean, we've established where Christina's from, where Chantel's from. Mm-hmm. Amy, tell people where you're from.
I am from New Orleans. Uh-huh. Well, the West Bank, if we're going to get technical. But I grew up here, spent most of my life here, and don't plan on leaving anytime soon.
There you go. And mm-hmm. I appreciate you being forthcoming about the West Bank
part. Yeah.
If you're here, you know.
Yeah.
Well, great. Well, y'all did a seminar today on sexual assault and violence in the hospitality industry, and we'll get into the topics a little bit more. But can you tell us, and I'll start with you, Christina, do you mind telling us a little bit about your background professionally in the industry, and then what brought you to address this issue or issues?
Yeah, so I've been in the industry ever since I started university and just needed a part-time job to pay for bills. So I started when I was 18, so about 13, 14 years now. I was really lucky in that I quickly went up through the ranks, so I've been a manager for probably about 10 of those years. That's taken me through a lot of different styles of venues, from super high dining to like clubs to neighborhood bars and everywhere in between. Right now, I am opening up a venue, but I do a lot of community work and I do a lot of fundraising, and that was partly what brought me to this panel. I do a lot of fundraising, especially around women-centered issues or women and queer-centered issues, and that came from me really not feeling fulfilled professionally with where my heart lies. I love a lot about the hospitality industry. And when I was looking at options for how I could spend my time to donate, I realized that it was probably better for me to figure out ways to fundraise and like tap into my markets, the ability that I know venues, I know liquor sponsors, I know people who like to spend $40 on random things. And I realized that I could do things where I raise money for people who are better at what I like to do, and they can then use that money and enact change.
Mm-hmm.
So partly through doing that and then becoming a little bit more of an advocate for those issues, I found that I was speaking a lot more about those issues, especially in the industry, because I'm not a very typical figure as well.
Okay.
Yeah, so.
Great. Thank you. Chantel, how about yourself?
Hi. So I am a trauma therapist and a community mobilization strategist, and I have been working out of New York City, working with survivors of sexual and intimate partner violence for the past 10 years out of a rape crisis program there. So a lot of the work that I do is about wedding my clinical expertise with community mobilization work and going into communities, partnering and helping them center their existing expertise around violence prevention in order to address barriers that they have in that community to safety and like the wholeness or well-being of that community. So a lot of like my work with Nightlife has been about how do I center and lift up the voices of people in this industry who are the curators of our communities, who do, you know, create the spaces where we fall in love, we meet our best friends, we experience life transitions, we celebrate the joys and the hardships of our lives, right?
Mm-hmm.
And who better to help lead our society in creating a true culture shift when it comes to preventing violence.
Great. Yeah. What drew you, I mean, maybe some of the reasons why you just said, what drew you to the hospitality or nightlife industry, as you put it in particular?
I think you know, it's interesting because I've been reflecting about that a lot recently, and I think that one of the things is that there are a lot of parallels between the hospitality industry and people that are working in mental health or the human services professions. Something that I've been kind of ranting about a lot, these ladies have been hearing me kind of say the same thing a lot, but I think one of the things that I'm really passionate about is about really kind of saying we need to start kind of raising the hierarchies around who actually has expertise in creating cultural change. And I think that as the people who are curating our communities, there's a great breadth of like emotional insight and knowledge in this industry who are literally trained to bear witness to people and to hold them as they're going through their lives. And so how do we actually honor that expertise and actually utilize it most effectively to keep each other safe? And so for me, I think some of the wisest people that I know that I've had the opportunity and the honor of collaborating with have been people in this industry because of the ways that they are passionate about caring for their communities and creating spaces where people feel safe. I just don't think they get the credit for it,
right,
you know?
Right.
And that kind of siloing of expertise, I think, is really dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't actually allow communities to sustainably continue this work without people like myself who come in and are like, well, here's a project, let's connect, right? And I think that needs to start changing where communities start taking responsibility and ownership for each other and the ways that they take care of each other moving through, you know, their lives.
Great.
So
excellent.
Mm-hmm.
Well said.
Thank you.
Amy, what about you?
So I have been in the restaurant industry for half my life, 16 years. It was my first job when I turned 16. I was a host at a chain restaurant. And I have and always will love the service industry. I owe so much to it. I have people that I consider family. I have restaurants and owners and these people who are like my second family, my second home. And I, you know, owe so much to it. I worked myself way through my undergraduate degree and my graduate degree by working in the service industry. At that time, when I was in graduate school getting my master's in counseling, I started to kind of wake up to the normalization of sexual violence within our industry and really start to notice not only was I being exposed to it, but others as well, and just seeing how normalized it was
mm-hmm.
and how pervasive and insidious it is. So whenever I first started interning with STAR, which is the nonprofit organization I work at now, stands for Sexual Trauma Awareness and Response, we're the only standalone sexual assault agency in New Orleans. I kind of brought this issue to them and was like, hey, I know that we're exploring different communities and the intersections of sexual violence and how we can kind of reach that population. What about the service industry? I feel like it was forgotten. So mm-hmm. I really tried to be that bridge person mm-hmm. for the organization I work for and the restaurant industry. And it was easy for me because I would, you know, connect the organization I was working with the restaurant, you know, company I was working with, and just trying to get the name out there and just kind of spread the word about STAR, how all of our services are free and confidential, which is important when you have service industry workers who don't have insurance, who don't have the expendable income to pay, you know, $100 for a counseling session.
Right.
So really just trying to get the word out there. And yeah, I'm just kind of that advocate in the community for the restaurant industry population and trying to really connect our organization with them to provide trainings, to provide free counseling, advocacy services, civil legal services. You know, there's a lot of times when people are fired or mistreated in their job because they speak out against sexual harassment.
What you were just saying.
Exactly. Yeah, they'll get blacklisted. So that's something that our organization can really help with. So mm-hmm. I'm here to not only be that person who has had a foot in both of those realms, but to also kind of be that connecting piece to really get the word out and help others in this industry.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Christina, let me ask you something that Amy just said, just so I think we're being clear with listeners. When we talk about having this be normalized in the industry, I think, and just this is my own perspective, that we're not talking about that it's swept, I mean, it can be swept under the rug, certainly, but I think we're talking about behavior that exists where it's like, that's cool, that's okay, it's just kind of how it is. Is that a fair way to put it?
Yeah, like, so in our seminar that we did, Amy and Star has this they have this great diagram that's the continuum of sexual violence. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I truly believe in hospitality is that when you look at that continuum and it talks about behaviors to like unwanted touching to all the way over to like rape and sex trafficking, a lot of people who are in hospitality spaces almost just erase behaviors, talking, mm-hmm. Almost like those behavior parts are almost always erased from the conversation of sexual mm-hmm. violence. And when you try to mention it and talk about it in the realm of sexual violence, they shut down. Mm-hmm. And then in some places also up to like unwanted touching, which can be anywhere from, we work in very close quarters, so mm-hmm. there is a lot of touching, mm-hmm. and not all of it is sexual violence, not to say that, but there's gray areas, right? It's like, do you touch somebody on their elbow to help, like, to ask them to move, because you don't always want to speak to each other, mm-hmm. Or do you touch them on their lower back, and how low on their lower back mm-hmm. are you touching them, and then are you grabbing their hips and moving them, and there's all these things that it starts to get into beyond, like, actual hazing and everything else that happens.
Right.
So it is pretty pervasive, in the hospitality industry, and a lot of it is used as bonding. A lot of it is not necessarily seen as what it is. A lot of it is used as ways of even bonding with our guests. Mm-hmm. Some of the easiest ways to make a guest like you can be flirting, or flirting back. And that's what people learn immediately until they learn the other skills that can also have the guests like you. And it depends where you work and what people want. And a lot of places that are not necessarily the highest skill set in the way that we like to say that there's a skill set for hospitality, where it might not be like the best wine list or the best food or whatever. Those are a lot of places where it becomes a bit more like sexual harassment becomes a lot more pervasive, and also what the guests expect that they can have an interaction with the
in the tone of that interaction. Then
yeah,
is that, yeah, okay.
Like it's like a lot of your dive bars, your regulars might want like that hot young bartender who they can talk to, who will make them feel special. Mm-hmm. And when everyone thinks that that's something that's normal to expect from someone who's supposed to just bring you probably a beer and some snacks, and if they think that person also has to make them feel loved, attractive, mm-hmm. and listen to their mm-hmm. day, and there is a whole realm of like things that we do that we should do that provides a service mm-hmm. To people, but we need to shift what that conversation looks like and shift what people expect and what mm-hmm. we expect of our staff.
Great. So these things in hospitality, and we got to take a break in about a minute and a half, y'all, but Chantel, so hospitality is not synonymous with affection, correct?
Mm. Yeah. I mean, I think something we were talking about yesterday that's mm-hmm. so powerful is, and one of our colleagues who was on the panel with us, Amy Northup, was naming this, I think, into the space, which is that we have to start redefining what hospitality actually means. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, there are many words in our kind of lexicon as a culture and a society that we have conflated or we've made synonymous with behaviors that are actually not authentically to that definition. When we're talking about hospitality, right, we've now shifted into seeing that as a transactional engagement. Mm-hmm. And there are reasons for that, right? And I think there's a lot of survival and resilience that can come out of behaviors that have been normalized in some sense. So I think it's really important to, when we're talking about this, not demonize that this has been normalized. Like a lot, you know, for a lot of people, you know, there's this assumption that that's like a gendered experience. It's not. There have been a lot of people who victim blame or who take issue with people who are mm-hmm. coming forward who are from the same sexual orientation or the same gender identity. And that idea of like, well, I survived this and I put up with it, so then therefore, like, you got
to
do
then
it
you
too.
You have to do it too.
Right.
Okay.
And I think also, just like I said, if you're redefining hospitality, then also you can start shifting away from like, one, who are you identifying as your customer? And also thinking critically about what we mean when we say the customer is always right.
Yeah,
right?
Great.
So this. I feel like the two of them can talk to about that a little
bit. Okay, great. Yeah, we'll do that. Let's take a little break here if y'all don't mind. And we're going to come back and continue the conversation. Friends, we're going to take a little break here on the Noel Drink Show. Come on back.
I ain't got nothing in my pocket. I got holes in both of my shoes. Ain't got nothing in my pocket. But if I did, I'd give half to you.
Mm-hmm.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in. And we're talking about a very important topic here, sexual violence, assault, and harassment in the hospitality industry. And just during the break, Amy, we were talking about sometimes people in this setting maybe confuse, don't really understand boundaries. What do you mean by that?
Well, boundaries is something that unfortunately we're never really taught. And a lot of the times you don't understand where even your own personal boundaries lie until they've been crossed. Mm. So one thing that really came up for me when we're talking about sexual violence in the service industry is just the lack of boundaries. And by that, I'm mainly talking about the staff. Because whenever you walk into a restaurant, you have like servers, bartenders, hosts, and it's almost like the patrons automatically assume that these people don't have any boundaries and that they can cross those boundaries and that as long as they're tipping or paying money or like patronizing the restaurant or the establishment, that we're pretty much fair game for anything. Mm-hmm. And I think that that is a really like awful assumption for people. And I mean, there are all kinds of stereotypes within the service industry, but just how it's taboo to even talk about sexual violence in general, I find it's even taboo to talk about boundaries. Because like we were kind of talking about during the break, is that say I am a server that has really good boundaries and somebody crosses those boundaries, me trying to reinforce it and say, hey, you know, actually, like, I don't like to be touched, but, you know, we could do this instead. There can be a barrier to somebody even expressing what their boundary is because of fear of like retaliation, fear of a bad Yelp review, of it, you know, a complaint made against them. So it kind of puts staff members in like a really precarious situation where it's like, you know, what is worth more, you know, like my own personal safety, my job security, my financial security. And I think that's something that a lot of people may not recognize or just be willing to talk about in general.
Yeah. It's a really excellent point. Can I ask you this question too, and to any of you, Amy? Because you mentioned something about the very beginning. What you were just talking about was the staff behavior, right? And how the staff interaction takes place. And is there sometimes a situation where, and I'm going to use an old term, we can still say this, I think, on the radio, where people were playing grab ass behind the bar,
right?
And then does that create a dynamic if that's going on and you're just having fun with your coworkers and those are within your boundaries, maybe not, but that's going on behind the bar, does that then influence the patron's behavior potentially? Is this kind of what we're talking about?
I think so. Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Because I think there is that piece of like, if boundaries are not being maintained behind the bar and if staff don't feel safe, that energy is inevitably going to come out to your patrons, right?
Mm-hmm. Right.
Because if they don't feel safe in and of themselves and how they're navigating, they're going to be prioritizing their own security and safety while navigating that space. And they don't have the capacity necessarily to then go out and like be critically thinking about the safety of the patrons, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then that inevitably, you know, when you're talking about bars that have quote unquote problems with, you know, repeated offenders, like people coming in and harming people within that space in a variety of ways, right? Like it's because there isn't kind of an oversight. It's because those boundaries are not being reinforced on the other side. And it's often a conversation, it's a trickle down conversation, right? One of the biggest things that we talk about in our work is the fact that a lot of owners and managers are also some of the people committing harm. And I think a part of this conversation that's really crucial, right, is talking about how talking about sexual violence is also about talking about accountability. It's about recentering who we are actually identifying as responsible when harm happens. And we often silo harm to the person who commits it and the person who experiences it. Mm-hmm. And we kind of say, okay, if you've committed harm, we're going to silo you to the criminal justice system. They're going to take care of justice. Mm-hmm. And if you're someone who's experienced harm, you're going to go over here to, you know, get mental health services, go to this, you know, individual therapist. And as a therapist, I of course want people to seek treatment and get support. That's really important. But what about our communities? It's almost like we're saying as a community, you go over there and get help and get fixed. You go over there and get justice for this person, which 99% of the time does not actually happen, right? Mm-hmm. But we're saying, well, that's the only way you can get justice. And then we're asking those people to then come back into community with us. And what are we doing to hold
with no
people
effective change when you step
exactly,
back in?
Exactly. Right? And how are we also complicit in and participating when we look the other way, when we don't say something? I think one of the biggest issues we also talk about a lot, and that I hear my colleagues here talk about, is how much violence people in the industry are witnessing and feeling helpless in responding to it, either because they don't realize that they might already have the tools, or they don't have support within their own community or the space that they're working in to, as Amy was talking about earlier, intervene in a way that either makes them feel safe or the patrons feel safe, right?
Right.
And so these are also some of the barriers, is talking about the vicarious trauma that a lot of people in this industry have. And when we're talking about normalizing, right, that you're then constantly seeing this over and over again and not having tools to address it, it can make you feel helpless and shut down in a conversation about prevention.
If you keep coming back and having the same thing happen, then you just do you give up trying, Christina? Is that the idea in a sense, maybe?
Yeah, and I do think that like people don't engage with the idea that when we're talking about sexual harassment and sexual harassment prevention specifically in restaurants, we're actually also talking about a labor issue that's no issue than anything, no different than anything else. Mm-hmm. It's no different than making sure people get paid on time or that they are working a certain amount of hours. Like to say that the sexual harassment is something different and something special is to say that, and especially when you look at what the population who are usually getting or more likely to be sexually harassed in a space are, it's like you're saying it's not important and it's just a side effect of your job, but it's not, it's something that if we address it, we're special, but we're special to do it. It's not something that's just an accommodation, like making sure people wear steel-toed boots when they have to move heavy things.
Right.
And I think what we have to do is we have to adjust it. Like, I'm very Canadian, and I'm like, so...
And we love it.
And like, so even, like, we were having our pre-seminar talk, and, like, there's no such thing as at-will firing in Canada.
Right, okay.
You can... You, more or less in most provinces, you can be fired within 3 months because it's a probationary period.
Like a trial.
Yeah, it's a trial period. You still have a lot of rights in those 3 months. And then after 3 months, they have to have a real reason to fire you. And it's like very specifically laid out. And then you get severance based on how long you worked. And it can't just be that you're like a little bit shitty at your job. Like,
right.
You still can't.
Right.
Like, so that's why everyone always tries to like be like, do we need this person? We have to get rid of them. Like, it's a 3 month mark. Hearing that it's at will, and it's not to go on a rant on like how Americans structure their labor force, but
You can do that.
But there's it really makes it so that if you are a predator, you are more protected as an owner or a manager because there's very little recourse for your staff. And it really reinforces bad behaviors. And I'm a really big believer that creating safe spaces for predators is something that we shouldn't do, and we should find a way to have
that
people,
sound reasoning right there.
Yeah, yeah. And like having, and like we should be focusing on the idea that like these rules that we have are really making predators more safe and not patrons, not guests, not workers, not people who could potentially be amazing owners themselves, amazing managers themselves, but they're getting pushed out because they're so worried that if they complain about something, they'll be fired and blackballed from an entire industry, and that's disheartening.
That's very, and it's very prevalent, especially in this country. I think we know that that's very prevalent and a distinct possibility. How about if we do this? Let's take a little break right now, and then we're going to come back and chat a little bit more. Come on back.
Goodbye, Joe. I got to go. Me oh my. Say a little prayer and drink up and thank the Lord for driving me home once more.
All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. Brian Diaz here with you, WGSO 990 AM in New Orleans and in podcast land, wherever you may be. Thank you very much for listening into the show today, friends. We're talking about sexual assault and violence in the hospitality and service industry, liquor industry, and really, by extension, all industries, I would imagine. And I'm joined here by Amy Noto, Chantel Gerday, and Christina Vera. Thank you all for being here. I really appreciate it today
thank
for
you
making
for
time.
Us. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. One thing that we wanted to talk about, y'all, to let you know, part of this is describing some things that if you're a patron of a place that you may not realize, and we've touched on some things of what the staff might be dealing with. And one of the ones that we talked about is we're talking about being able to seek help and resources, but lots of times being able to seek help takes resources. And a lot of people don't have health insurance in the industry. And people maybe don't realize that, yeah, it's easy to say, yeah, go, as you were saying, Chantal, during the break, yeah, you know, go get help. Well, that's a tough thing just even from a financial perspective, right?
Right. And I think also the other piece of this is that how we define help, right? And that I think what's really, really important too is for me as a therapist is often really giving people permission to know that healing can look different for everyone, and also seeking help is something that can be a really big process. Some people aren't ready to do that right after they've experienced violence, and it can take time. I've worked with people, you know, who experienced sexual violence in childhood and who until they, you know, they wake up at 35 and are suddenly like, I think I need to deal with this. I need to address this, right? And so I think for a lot of the work that in particular Amy Noto and I do as clinicians is really normalizing how people cope with sexual violence as a trauma. So normalizing that people get help and should get help when they're ready, and help can look like a lot of different things. It can look like coming in and getting therapy with people who are trauma-informed as therapists. It can look like working with a rape crisis program. It can also look like finding any other kind of holistic, you know, way of addressing this. I think, you know, for a lot of people, it's being able to tell your story and name what happened to you to people in your life who are safe and who care about you, and being validated in that experience. And I think also the really big piece to this is, in terms of barriers, is recognizing that actually across a majority of the United States, most states actually have funding to work with survivors of violence. And I feel like that's also similar in Canada as well, right?
Yeah, like we were talking about in, it varies from province to province. So you have like your normal ways of what people know to go through justice, where you can go criminally. You can do it civilly if you say sue someone. In most provinces, there's a victim services fund that you actually don't have to have a criminal case to apply to. It doesn't actually relate to your aggressor in any way, which is a really good way of going about justice as well, because a big barrier is, besides the fact that conviction rates are really low and even bringing it to court is really low, a lot of it is that people are afraid, or they don't want to have to directly go against the person
that can create trauma, right? Yeah. Or enhance the trauma.
That whole process itself can be traumatic. So there are victim services funds and like different ones that are from the government that are set up for that. They're not only for sexual violence, but they are also for sexual violence. And that is actually a very helpful way for a lot of survivors to feel seen, to get funding. And like, it's not, they're not getting $1 million, right? But they're getting often a few thousand, and that can go towards therapy, that can go towards offsetting costs of not working. When people leave their jobs or are fired or quit or whatever because of something that happened to them, they often also have the financial penalty of not being able to make money.
Right.
And that's really real.
That's very real.
Yeah.
Right?
I think a really important resource, if we like saying this on air across the country, is if you are in need of support, or if you or someone you love really needs to get support around sexual violence or intimate partner violence even, because it can be connected oftentimes, is you can go to www.rainn.org. It's a site that actually is a service map for the country, and so you can actually see what resources are local to your area, and that's both for mental health services and social service support. It's for legal advocacy. It's for criminal justice advocacy, right? And then also sometimes, like, you know, Christina was saying, it's also for that kind of fiscal support and advocacy, but they basically will help you find the resources that are local to you. They also have online crisis chat, and they have a hotline. Do you remember the number? 1-800-656 Hope.
Very good.
I think I got it.
Nice. Very good.
Y'all can Google it.
Yeah.
And check me.
Well, you guys will share the links with me, right? And we'll put this in the show notes and stuff.
Yeah. I don't know if anyone is actually listening from Canada, but a really good website.
We got a few.
Oh, perfect. a good website to find out about a variety of different groups, be it rape crisis centers, training groups, women's shelters. There's a website called solidarityforsurvivors.com. That actually came about because of a pretty big sexual harassment scandal, if you want to call it a scandal, that came out in the hospitality industry a couple years ago with a really prominent winemaker, and just how that was handled both criminally and by the newspaper that reported it. So anyway, solidarityforsurvivors.com lists people and organizations across Canada.
Great. Yeah. Okay. Let me ask you this question, Christine. And y'all, in a couple minutes, we got to get into how we connect you and close off the radio portion of the show. These three are sticking around for another shot with Noah Drink, so the conversation will continue on the podcast. But Christina, when in the places that you manage, sort of briefly tell us from a patron side, how do you do some things to make sure that it's a safe place for your staff, and how handling patrons that are out of line.
Yeah. Ways that you can make it a safe place for your staff, and it's always a moving target. One, having just house rules, like everyone knowing how they should engage, what is expected of them. I found that the easiest way to make staff feel safe and to make it safe is to have really clear lines of like where the staff have autonomy, where they're allowed to use their discretion, really trusting them in the moment, not necessarily critiquing when, say, they want to cut off somebody or when they're having a negative interaction with a guest in that moment, but like kind of trying to take a step back and looking at it as patterns. A lot of your staff might make the wrong judgment call when they're learning how to make good judgment calls.
Sure,
you have to let them make the wrong judgment call in it. You can't shut down that impulse, and then because they will then start to disallow everything. It's really hard to train staff to have initiative, and you don't want to stifle that if they have that. Letting them know, like, you can cut somebody off, or you don't have to interact with somebody. I like to have a policy where you would rather, if a guest was being inappropriate, that we find proactive and positive ways to not have them in your space anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Some places like to do the thing where they just switch the server out. I don't mind that as much when you are a really large place, when you're a 30-seat place.
It's
which
not practical,
it doesn't really.
Yeah.
There's that person still in the space, still making somebody uncomfortable, right?
Right.
And you're still really prioritizing the comfort of that guest that is toxic over your staff that you are theoretically hoping to have with you for a really long time. But yeah, I really think that a lot of it is having your staff telling your staff what you think the boundaries should be, really enforcing them, giving them the power to also enforce.
And having this
as
a regular part of your staff conversation, right?
Mm-hmm. You should always be communicating with your staff, and that is something that restaurants and bars are really bad at doing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're really bad at just having conversations, not about like wine list changes or menu changes or like a new table number or like patio setup, mm-hmm. but like actually having conversations about like your culture of your place and what is happening, mm-hmm. what is going on, how you feel.
That's a great point.
And I think like a piece of that that's so important is really talking about how do we create protocol and policy that reflects mm-hmm. the work that we're doing, and how do we make sure it's informed by the expertise of your staff in
that
space.
Yeah, and I want to get into that in the podcast only portions of this. Is something Amy and I have talked about quite a bit to mm-hmm. a degree just offline. Amy, do me a favor, tell people where they can find out more about STAR, please.
So STAR, again, it stands for Sexual Trauma Awareness and Response. We are a local sexual assault agency in New Orleans. We serve the greater New Orleans area. We have a 24-hour crisis hotline. The number is 1-855-435-STAR. You can call that number anytime and speak to one of our trained advocates. They can connect you to resources, connect you to our organization. And you can also visit us on our website. It's star.ngo.
Great. Thank you. Chantal, how do we connect with you?
So actually, I'll give you my email. We're
okay.
Working on our website right now, but my colleague Amy Northup and I both do consulting across the country around both building protocol and policy, training, and then crisis response services.
Great. So we'll put that on the show
yep.
notes when the
Absolutely.
Show comes out. Perfect. And Christina, you
yeah,
please.
And I'll leave you my email as well.
Okay,
yeah.
Great. We'll do that. we'll leave the country code stuff out of this, right, for telephone calls and whatnot. Friends, thanks for listening into the show here on the radio portion. I do encourage you, if you're listening on the radio, please go get the podcast. It's on your favorite podcast platform. Also at noladrinks.com, because these three are going to stick around for another shot with Nola Drinks, and we're going to talk more on this important topic. But if you're listening here on the radio, friends, remember, be kind to one another, use your turn signal, and until next time, cheers, y'all.
this. I said, I call your name, but no one came. Now I see you become just like the company you keep. Then he said, all these saints and all these sinners will try to bend your.
All right, everybody. Hey, thanks for sticking around for another shot with Noah Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Hope you are enjoying and finding the conversation we are having with Amy, Chantel, and Christina. Interesting and important conversation, friends, as we noted at the top of the show and on these topics as part of our sustainability series, something that we will continue to bring to you. We're going to bounce right back over to Two Jags and continue our conversation with them. Here we go. All right, everybody, another shot with Noah Drinks. Brian Diaz here with you. Thanks for listening in, friends. As always, this week we're here with our Tales of the Cocktail coverage. It rolls on. And a quick shout-out and thanks to our good friends here at Two Jags, 831 Decatur Street, I believe it is, 800 block of Decatur, second oldest restaurant in New Orleans, and they're hosting us here today, as they often do, and we really appreciate that. Chatting with Amy, Chantel, and Christina, and we're talking about sexual assault and violence in the hospitality industry. One of the things that we were talking about, and we kind of touched on it in certain ways during the first portion of the show, and Amy, this is a conversation you and I have had over the past year and a half or so, just sort of offline whenever I run into you, and we talked about this idea, Chantel mentioned this, of expertise, and one of the things I was kind of harping on, this is, I don't know, like 12 months ago or 16 months ago, I was saying, for God's sakes, please, people, don't start another nonprofit.
And I
get the idea is the heart is in the right place.
Don't reinvent the wheel.
Give your energy and give your resources and all of that kind of stuff to help somebody who knows really what the hell it is that they're doing. And I think that to me, when you were talking about that, Chantel, about the expertise component of this, there are people who are really good at these things. So opening the doors to bring those resources in is far more effective than saying, hey, I'm going to start a nonprofit that does this, because there's already 10 out there that do it and have been doing it for a long time and, in my view, doing it better than you could probably do it.
That's been my experience here. And at STAR, you know, a lot of people just see us as an organization that primarily deals with survivors, which is true and is always our number one priority and focus. But we actually have trainings, education, consulting services to offer the community. And I really want to kind of get the word out there on that. We have one training called Hospitality and Harassment Don't Mix. We actually did it last year at Tales. We did it again this year at Tales. We've worked with Tales of the Cocktail on rewriting their human resource policy in regards to sexual violence and sexual harassment. And we offer those consulting services to any restaurants, businesses, hotels, anybody out there that wants to make an improvement on their policies and procedures but just doesn't really know where to start. You know, there's some, like, legality stuff in there, too. Reach out to STAR. We are here to help with that. We are a resource to you in the community, and, you know, take advantage of that.
And people can find programs, like, if they're not in New Orleans, right? Mm-hmm. There's very likely there could be similar programs elsewhere, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And I think, you know, kind of speaking to what you were saying about expertise, like, I would actually gently push back and say that there actually needs to be a shift in nonprofit culture to actually center the expertises of the communities that they serve. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the work that I do in consulting and when in building is really saying, how do we co-create content that authentically reflects the lived narratives of the people that we're working with and lets them kind of facilitate more peer-led growth?
This is proper stakeholder engagement we're talking about, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, that these are not mutual exclusives. In my view, that, you know, we're talking about the people that you serve have to have the primary voice in all of this. That's absolutely critical. Mm-hmm. I think what we're talking about is when you have people that are not. My point was simply just coming from
informed.
An angle, not being informed and saying, "I'm going to start a nonprofit to address this issue," when Amy's organization is already doing that in town, and we don't.
that's who we need to support
absolutely.
To do this.
No, and I think that's absolutely true. And I think one of the most important crucial pieces to that is that anytime you're doing training that is related to violence and preventing violence is that that work has to be trauma-informed and survivor-centered.
Absolutely.
And that is where that collaboration is so powerful, is bringing in the clinical skills of professionals like ourselves and matching it with industry professionals and saying, how do we actually create content that really is reflecting something that's both authentic to what's happening in the here and now, but is also creating safety and space for people to access not only prevention tools, but crisis response tools, right? Mm-hmm. To that point, there are people who are doing this work in the here and now that are, you know, able to provide that crisis response kind of care. And then I think also that that builds capacity for staff to feel safe enough to engage in prevention. So many people don't want to have conversations about prevention because they're dealing and mitigating with violence on the day every single day.
Yeah, so you're not, you're being reactive instead of proactive.
Okay. There's no space to. You're burnt out. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's kind of the piece, too, is making sure that prevention is hand in hand with crisis response, that people feel supported and heard and seen while building spaces to be safer, right?
Mm-hmm. So. Christina, coming from working in the industry side of things, kind of taking from what they said, then how do you approach this? Opening doors to bringing these resources in, maybe?
Yeah, like I think what is hard sometimes too, why it's really important for these for these organizations to use people who have a nightlife background and to be very collaborative in their approach, is overwhelmingly people who are in restaurants and bars are like, they're not, everyone is different, but in general, everyone's pretty results-focused. Everyone is very much, like, of the moment. They're pretty reactive as people. It's just, like, how you have to train yourself. You have to be somebody who actually thinks a two-minute delay on a vodka soda is, like, the end of the world. I mean, like, that is, in of itself, like, lends itself to a very specific personality type. So I noticed in the beginning of trainings, and I feel like trainings across the world, across the country, across what have you, are getting a lot better at this. But I remember I have a lot of friends who work in social justice and in policy. I do a lot of that on the side and like whatever, and I read a lot of those papers. And even I would sit in talks and I'm like, this is just washing over everyone. These words that mean a lot in like nonprofit circles mean absolutely nothing to somebody who actually has to activate this. And it's not theory. And it's also not even necessarily happening in one incident at one time. It might be happening in 10 incidents at once in this room. So when you're only talking about like engagement and like certain things, like you're not really talking about what the reality has to look for. So it's always great to center everything in practicalities, and it can seem really infantilizing at first to people who like this is the work that they do, and it's like pretty high level to them. But it's because our job in hospitality is rooted in practicalities, and it doesn't make sense just to be like, well, these are our policies, but people don't know how they actually activate them.
It doesn't do any good, right?
It doesn't do any good, and they just don't do them. They just won't do it. And, like, I feel, like, especially when I'm on these panels, I always, like, liken everything to, like, checklists or, like, how you, like, tell someone to fold a napkin or you show someone to, like, polish glassware, because those are also things that people struggle with their staff every single day, right? Like,
right.
And it's all about, like, certain basic steps, basic principles and building up for it, and, like, having prevention and having safety as a basic principle is just something that if we as an industry start doing, we will see positive ramifications and effects from it.
Okay, great. Amy, let me ask you this question or maybe make some comments on this, because something that you said, you're an important linchpin type person in all this, I think, because you worked in the hospitality industry for a long time. So you, I imagine, know exactly where Christina is coming from. But then you also do have that theoretical program, nonprofit background in all of this. And I think that's what we... To me, that's just so important, because that kind of addresses what we're talking about.
Absolutely.
You're a great person to engage stakeholders, because you were one on that side and now you're one on the other.
Yeah, and whenever I kind of brought it to Star, like, look, this is untapped territory that nobody is exploring. I really think that we should. This is a need that needs to be met in the community. You know, let's make resources and training available to that. Star was very receptive to it. And I think it's because I am that person coming from that world into the nonprofit sector. kind of exposing, like, look, this is a problem too, and it fits within our mission. So on some of the trainings that we've developed, we try and tailor our trainings to our audience. So with Hospitality and Harassment Don't Mix, you know, me and Rachel Hebert, our CEO, you know, she asked me for some of my input on that because she understands that I'm coming from that world, and she wanted to make it engaging. You know, what scenarios can we use that are, you know, realistic and things that everybody faces? So yeah, I am sort of that bridge person, and that's my passion, and the advocacy portion of the work that I do is to really bring this to the service industry, because I mean, it's like my second home, and I'm really like pushing for this culture shift, and I think it can really happen. It's gaining traction now ever since the John Besh thing broke. And yeah, I think it's really important to get the education out there, to get the training out there.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Chantal, would you add to that a little bit too? Because I mean, let me ask you this question. I mean, doing what you do, so coming more, you know, obviously from the service and side of all this, have you experienced pushback from people when you try and engage with the industry in certain ways?
Absolutely. And I would actually say that a lot of that resistance is fear and anxiety based. You know, I think one of the things that's really important to think about is how this industry can be super liability focused versus human focused. And so a lot of the work that I do is about humanizing that anxiety, normalizing that we mess up. Culture change doesn't happen without mistakes. Culture change doesn't happen without really uncomfortable corners of growth, right? Like, or like growing corners. And I think so much of the work that I do, and you know, I was saying this yesterday in our seminar, is that I know that our work is successful when an operator feels safe enough to call me and say, Chantal, you know, we just had this situation happen, you know, at the bar last night. I don't know if we dealt with it right. Can I run it by you? What do you think? What are maybe some other ways we could have dealt with this? Or when they call me and say, hey, one of my staff members disclosed, do you think you can help me get them access to care? And really investing for me in relationships with people and not doing a one-size-fits-all or a one-stop-shop training, and really saying, actually, the training is only one small piece of this conversation. It's actually building an authentic relationship in which you feel safe enough to be vulnerable in growing and changing the culture of your spaces and feel safe enough to come to me, and we can build that together. I think that's one of the most powerful things about kind of engaging community mobilization or organizing work with crisis response and with prevention, is really kind of galvanizing people to think about, actually, prevention happens when we feel safe enough to be honest about what's happening for us, and we give other people the space to be honest about what's happening for them, and not shaming people for that. I think there's a lot of fear in this industry, particularly after the Me Too movement kind of really broke and was gaining momentum, because, you know, the concept of call-up culture is so polarizing. People are terrified that if I make one slight mistake, I'm going to be blacklisted. You know, so much of this work really is about saying that we have to engage around recognizing that people we love and care about commit harm. And again, going back to that piece around accountability, right? And saying, like, that means we do have to slow down and really look at the fact, well, have I been participating in that? Have I been complicit in that? How can, you know, myself and the people that I care about really actually authentically engage in this conversation? A part of it is building these kinds of relationships and having access to this kind of, you know, information and care.
Great. So, yeah. Great. Christina, let me, is there anything, we've kind of touched on this a little bit here, but, you know, practical things that maybe we haven't said yet to implement these things and actually make these things work in a real world situation, as you were saying before. Like, if you're a manager, if you're an owner, if you're a floor manager or even an employee, what are things, you know, what haven't we touched on? What do you do? How do we make this work?
I mean, there's so many. One of the easiest steps is to have really clear rules around staff drinking, especially after work, including also who you allow to stay after. There's a whole thing where, say, people might find someone who's sitting at their bar attractive, give them drinks all night, then have that person sit at the bar while they're doing cash out.
Stay after.
Especially if you're a manager, like, you shouldn't really be doing that.
Like after hours.
Cutting down on staff drinking is really good, because it also means that you're making sure that your staff is probably going to be a lot more clear and clear-minded, especially when things happen, good or bad. It's just good for them to... And it also, like, helps navigate those boundaries a bit too, even with your guests. When your guests see your staff drinking a lot, they often think like anything goes, and it makes them think that the staff are part of the party, and the staff aren't part of the party, right? Like, they're there still to be working and to like provide an experience. So that's like one really good way to do it. I mean, always just having, I think when you're doing your onboarding, having it as part of your training, like really talking about how everyone interacts with each other, like what, if someone makes you feel uncomfortable, what you're going to, how you're going to go about it, what the routes they're going to take, and like always following up on that, I think is really good. And having check-ins with your staff about that. I think having check-ins with your staff, especially about regulars, is really good. Sometimes regulars can be really awesome. I'm really lucky. Like I've had regulars who followed me from places for like 10 years. But some regulars are bad regulars, and some, and they go to your place all the time because you let them get away with more shit than everyone else lets them get away with. So checking in with your staff just to make sure that they don't feel obligated to create this warm experience for someone that consistently comes in and makes them feel uncomfortable or pushes the boundary is really good. Just like in terms of like really baseline, if you have security, if you have security staff, like really engaging with your security staff with all of this, they're almost the people who need to know the most. They're the people who have, their whole job is often just watching how your guests are interacting with each other and with your staff. They're the ones who will, who should be the front lines of interactions with your guests, especially like interventions. So they should be on the same page as everyone else. They should be part of the conversation, especially when it comes to like even how you welcome guests, who you are navigating this space to. And then I also think like having as diverse a staff as possible in terms of like race, class, sexuality, gender, in its own way really helps because you start, you have less blind spots the more heterogeneous your staff are.
You
tend to be more aware of things. I also just like, I mean, I am a black lady, but I also like having a very diverse staff because I find even people who come from a variety of backgrounds have different tolerances of things. And that can be even just good from a customer service perspective, because something that might bother me might not bother somebody else. And we're not talking about sexual harassment in that case. It could just be like the way someone just orders.
Right.
The way that they wave at you. And sometimes you're just like, I cannot with this table. And someone's like, oh, I'm completely unbothered. Like, I'll do it. And they get along, right? Like, it's good to mix it up, and it's good to have those perspectives in there because they will lend more to each other.
That's a great point. We've actually talked about that topic specifically on the show before, about diversity in staff and the idea that, you know, it's good business because you sort of have people that are, can be ambassadors to different audiences, and that's just smart for a whole lot of reasons.
My family is Jamaican before they moved to Canada, and Jamaicans are like one of those cultures that can be brusque. And like, so like people who are I don't see being brusque as being impolite. So it doesn't bother me. Like Russians are really brusque. Like there's a few people, but it's like it's just like a few cultures.
It's
really
to the point.
Like,
your name is.
Like, I'm just like trying to go through it, but like I like don't mind it. I'm like, I like, it doesn't check for anything. Like I don't think that they're being rude at all. Whereas I've noticed like when I come down south, like just the amount of conversations people want to have with you, like just walking down the street, like going into Walgreens, like in your Uber, and Canadians are like pretty quiet. It's like a very British thing. Like we just don't like talk to people randomly. So I feel like I'm constantly on the verge of being rude by accident.
Just in my head. Amy and I always talk about it as like, as New Yorkers, it's like you walk down the street and you're like, why are you talking to me?
What do you want?
Exactly.
What do you want?
Like, what do you get?
Yeah, not
it's like,
here.
Right, you gotta like lower down.
Exactly. Well, any final thoughts, Chantelle or Amy?
I really just think that, you know, something that investing in training is really important, and something that's really crucial that Christina talked about is normalizing both practical skills training and like kind of human services training, and really kind of creating more equity in what you're valuing and the expertise of your staff, right? So if you're normalizing that sexual violence prevention training, bystander intervention training, having those resources available, it's just a normal, healthy part of how you talk about safety and like success in your space. That often really takes a lot of that pressure off, I think, in terms of shifting the culture. It doesn't feel so scary. And I think also for people to understand that bystander intervention training in and of itself is not like It's not creating conflict. It's mm-hmm. actually about de-escalating these very small moments that could end up in something very violent, oftentimes not even on premise, but off premise. And it goes back to that idea of saying, we need to care for the people in our communities and take, and like the fact that you could do something as small as just checking in and making eye contact with your patrons in your bar could be the difference between someone going home with someone that makes them feel uncomfortable and unsafe because no one saw what was happening to them in your space, and someone actually having a really great night and feeling empowered to actually say, actually, you know what, I don't feel comfortable, and I'm going to, like, you know, kind of jet out of this date mm-hmm, or whatever, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. So I think that's really important. And I think also just kind of, again, that balance of saying, how do we make sure that people have access to care and crisis support in the midst of learning how to change culture? Mm-hmm. Because it is going to be a process. It takes time. But that kind of, I think, blending of skill sets is really important for people and helping people feel safe when they disclose and knowing mm-hmm. what people's options are. Again, moving away from liability and fear-focused kind of reactive programming, right. But really being yeah. proactive mm-hmm. Is really, really crucial here. Mm-hmm. Great and powerful. Yeah.
Anything?
Yeah, and one thing I think is really important is that these conversations should continue. And just something to say to anybody who works in the hospitality industry, you have power. Whether yes. or not you think you do, you have power. And I know it may not always feel like that, but you have power in numbers. And I think talking about these types of issues amongst one another, really forming a community, organizing that, being able to advocate for yourself and really, you know, say, this isn't right. I don't have to be treated like this. My safety shouldn't have to be compromised when I go into a shift. I think that really understanding that you do have power and there's a lot that can come from that, and that the culture change starts with that.
Great, great point. Thank you all so much for being here. I really appreciate it and addressing the topic and sharing some time and so on and so forth. Friends, we will be sure to share information. You'll find it in the show notes once the show's out on the NOLA Drinks website, and we'll link to all the stuff through the social interwebs, as it were. But again, thank you so much for being here. It was a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
This is such a joy.
Thank you. Friends, we're going to take a brief musical interlude, and I'll be back with my parting shot. All right, everybody, thanks for listening into the show this week. As always, friends, I do appreciate it. Hope you found that very important conversation informative as well as interesting to you, and hopefully some things to think about when you're out in these spaces. Obviously, as we touched on, when we're around alcohol and really we look back at kind of the view that we maybe had or some of us have or culture has had, society has had of the bar scene and being in bars and what that was and really what it should be moving forward. Hopefully, again, something just to kind of think about everybody's behavior, boundaries, that sort of thing. And one point that I'll add as well, too, is that people at work, our friends in the hospitality industry, have a right to feel safe in their workspace, just like we do as patrons in those spaces. So we all need to work together to make that happen, friends. We will continue to address this issue on future shows here on the NOLA Drinks Show, so stay tuned for that. We'll have some more programming coming up in the next 2 to 3 weeks as well, some other stuff that we recorded at Tales of the Cocktail, and some other stuff. Yeah, there'll be other stuff too, because that's what we do here on the show. Here's our parting shot. One, to mention something about Tales of the Cocktail they just put out not too long ago the other day. Some information, the results from this year's version, the 17th annual Tales of the Cocktail, but only the second under the new leadership team. And as we noted when we did our Tales of the Cocktail annual preview show, only the first full year under the new leadership team, because they took over with just a handful of months, maybe 6 months or so, before last year's event, the 16th annual Tales of the Cocktail, and this was the 17th, as I said. So things are still kind of changing, and that's one of the points here that I wanted to make. Get into some of the numbers here in just a second, but I always kind of forget. I was having a conversation with a friend the other day, you know, pretty close to this, people that are connected to Tales of the Cocktail, the leadership team, many of the staff members I count as friends. Of course, we worked with them this year to bring you some of these shows, including the one that we heard today. So, you know, could kind of be a little insular, in all of this. And for a lot of people out there, and maybe some of you listeners out there even, they haven't really been aware of what the change of leadership has meant
to the foundation, the Tales of the Cocktail Foundation. It's important stuff. I think after we looked at this year, there was a good vibe. The brands have come back last year. In some cases, it was a little late for them to get back into the game when the leadership changed because they had already allocated their budgets, for example, for the year, that sort of thing. And I think we're seeing a lot of enthusiasm, the retooling of the organization to turn it into a true educational nonprofit foundation is incredibly important. And I firmly believe in what this group is doing, or what they are doing, and what they're trying to achieve. But it is still a work in progress, as they like to say. So ideally, as we move forward, we are mindful of that. We keep that in our considerations. They are very open to suggestions. They're very open to feedback. So provide it and see what you want to see. But I will say that I hope everyone out there realizes it's a new world for Tales of the Cocktail as we move forward and you continue to support them. But I wanted to note a couple of the numbers. As I said, attendance was up nearly 6,000 attendees from 2018, as we touched on a second ago, or sort of alluded to. A much smaller footprint last year with brands, that also meant a smaller footprint for the number of attendees because of various factors that we've talked about a lot on the show. This year's attendees represented 38 countries worldwide. There were over 100 new offsite events for Tales programming in 2019. That brought the total to over 400 events throughout the week-long conference. They also offered over 50 hours of free Beyond the Bar programming. This was free to everyone, whether you were actually participating in Tales or not, and open and encouraged people, especially in the New Orleans community, to attend. A lot of stuff on wellness, which I think was great. They had a sponsorship was back up. They had nearly 200 sponsors supporting things this year. Importantly, Tales of the Cocktail introduced an additional 17 seminars this year. That brought the total to 78. But what is also different, as you can tell by some of the shows, like the show we did today based on a seminar on sexual assault and violence in the hospitality industry, more of the seminars focused on pressing issues that range from diversity to inclusion. The show that we did 3 weeks ago, or yeah, 2 weeks ago on inclusion, there'll be a couple more that were based on seminars. Really, we're very happy with what Tales of the Cocktail are doing and very supportive of them in these efforts, and hence why we wanted to do shows based on some of these important seminars. But moving forward, 80% of the seminars were at over 80% capacity, and over 65% were over 90% capacity. So I think people are really vibing with it, understanding the importance. I think we're seeing a change in the industry on numerous levels, which is very, very, very important. And the people at Tales of the Cocktail should be very proud of having a hand in that. Last little fact that I'll give you here, that they offered another $100,000 in grants through its grant program, a very important linchpin thing that they're doing. That brings the total to $350,000 distributed to industry initiatives in the past couple years, putting their money where their mouth is, friends. And one of the things that you've heard me say over the past 2 to 3 years in regards to Tales of the Cocktail previously, in my view, I think they were trying to be too many things to too many people and trying to reinvent the wheel very often. I'm a firm believer in bringing the experts, bringing those who know just what the hell they're doing, and let them do their job, work with them and support them with resources. Don't reinvent the wheel. I think it's a really important thing. We actually talked about it on this episode a little bit as well. And I think Tales is doing a good job to identify people who are best suited to drive change, address issues, develop programming, and that sort of thing. And the grants program is indicative of that to me. So bravo to them for that. Look forward to what the next year brings and the 18th annual Tales of the Cocktail, which will take place next July, and all the other good year-round programming they have in between. You know we'll be there, friends. That's our parting shot. Here's to you.